Senate Judiciary Committee, February 25th, 1991.
Let's go ahead. We've got a number of bills. Committee will come to order. We have a number of bills on work session today. Let us start down Senate Bill 429, which is the securities bill that we've been dealing with, and we had some testimony last time from one segment of the securities industry that wanted to add some language, and I guess let's turn to Bill Taylor. And
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 429, we have before us the Dash 1 amendments, and what these amendments do is they basically replace the original bill. And if you will see in front of you, this is, I know it's early forgotten
excuse
stuff.
Excuse us for being a little nervous about this, because
What the bill does is it combines three aspects in one bill. It combines, it leaves the burden of proof on a professional for those services.
Excuse,
the professional.
No, we've gone through everything.
Okay.
Except, we've adopted everything except the additional language, which has been offered.
We've adopted the Dash 1 amendment.
I do not. My record show that we have not, but I could be wrong.
Okay, well, we don't need to go through the Dash 1 amendments except for whatever additional language
sure.
is being offered.
Okay.
We've been through that once already.
Okay, I'm sure. You'll see in front of you in red amended pages 4 and 8 of the Dash 1 amendments that were just handed out. And
what this bill does
on page 4, lines 24, after or, it adds the word solely. On page 8, lines 5, after the word including, conduct resulting in. That's the additional language, I believe, that was.
Are you sure? I'm not questioning. You sounded like you weren't quite sure whether you thought that was all.
Well, excuse me, also on page 4, line 2. After the word including has conduct resulting in.
Okay. We have the Dash 1 amendments, which is the rewrite, which the working group has been out during the interim and brought to us. We had testimony at the, we held work session over for a one segment of the industry, securities industry, to come and explicitly ask their recommendation was that we make it clear in lines 2, page 4, that we're talking about conduct here resulting in these kinds of behaviors. And then 24, they have asked that the word solely be added after or.
Madam Chair.
Senator Springer.
I know that people work pretty long and hard on this, and I'm satisfied this is just about a consensus with the amendments. So I would move the Dash 1 amendments with the amendments described by council by interlineation on pages 4 and 8.
Senator Springer has moved Dash 1 with the additional words as noted by Bill Taylor. Are there any objections to Springer's motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'd move the bill as amended. I assume it goes to the floor. Do pass?
Yes. Senator Springer is moving Senate Bill 429 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much.
We agree.
Sure. Okay, then let's move to Senate Bill 401. Take care of that one quickly.
Okay.
That's the Money Claims Act. There should be other amendments.
Yes, there are.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 401 was last before the committee on the 4th of February, and the bill basically allows a judgment expressed in foreign money to be paid in that currency, or when the debtor wishes to pay pay in U.S. dollars, adopt the day of judgment as the day of which conversion would be. There is a dash one amendments in front of you. These are proposed by the proponents of the bill, and they are basically clarifying amendments that, among other things, would give the parties the right to vary from the law if they wanted by contract, and also clarifies how this bill relates to certain internal court matters as far as judgment and docketing. I'd also, for further information, address your attention to Mark Thorburn's memo of 2/20/91 to me on the amendments.
I guess I have one question. Did we actually check with the Treasurer's Office on this?
Yes, Madam Chair. We've checked with the Treasurer's Office, and I believe there's a letter in your file in which they have agreed or they sent to the bill.
Yes. I see something from Cease Monroe.
That's correct. Oh, excuse me, Insurance and Finance.
That's not the Treasurer's Office.
That's correct. I did speak to Mr. Barton, and he is here today, I've been informed they did check the Treasurer's Office.
Wait, why don't you come on up, Mr. Barton, and we'll double check on that.
I have not checked with the Treasurer's Office because the request was talked to Banking Finance, and we did talk to the Oregon Bankers Association, but not to Treasury and such. I have not consulted with them. The Department of Banking and Finance for the Special Office of Banking and World. And I apologize.
Okay, well, let's hold this over.
Okay. Now, who's the Department of
State Treasurer?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Do we have controversy with 382?
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair, there is some controversy on this bill, I believe.
Which one?
There's a Mr. West here from the real estate section of the bar.
Mm. Okay, let's go ahead and take up 382.
Madam Chair, this bill is a dash two amendments to this bill. We last heard this on the 25th of January. What it does, it clarifies that line of credit instruments apply both to commercial and consumer loans, that payments made for insurance and taxes have priority status, that maturity date on a loan must be disclosed in the front of the line of the credit agreement, that a line of credit instrument may be used with security agreements other than mortgages, i.e. trust deeds. Also, that borrowers in a consumer transaction may limit the line of credit instrument's indebtedness secured by the line of credit instrument. I did have some communications this morning and concerning the creditor section of the bar and the real estate section of the bar, and I believe that there's been some controversy over the lines 1-4 of the dash 2 amendments. And that basically relates to construction loans, and I think if Mr. West is here, he may be better able to address that. And I believe Mr. Rodman, too.
Would you direct us more carefully to controversy lines 1-4 in the amendments or the original bill?
On the dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I don't seem to have dash 2
I don't have dash
amendments.
Two,
I have dash 1 amendments.
Actually, that's what I have, too.
I could address your attention to the dash one amendments also.
Okay. Let's look at the dash one amendments then, since we don't seem to have dash two.
The only difference between dash one and dash two is the fact on line 5 there's an addition there.
An addition of what?
In line 5, delete after the date of recording and. But for the purposes of this controversy, the lines 1-4 on the dash 1 amendments are the same as the dash 2.
I don't have a hand in gross, but I can't. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. What are we supposed to delete to bring the two into line?
But it's not a question.
If you look at your bill, the regular bill.
Yeah, right, I got it.
Full bill. I think that's real clear. We have no controversy, at least that I'm aware of, on line 20.
That's correct.
The original bill.
Mm-hmm.
Page 1, line 20. We had testimony that suggested that we delete after the word time, after the date of recording and. So that it would read there, principal advances made any time pursuant to the credit agreement. That's the amendment that was offered, and I think that met basically with the committee's favor at that point. So that is that's what resulted in the dash two amendments. We have since had some controversy with respect to dash one on page one, which deals with the principal amounts being exceeded by advances to complete construction, and again with construction liens. Mr. West, why don't you come on?
And Mr. Rodman, too, I believe.
Right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe West, here on behalf of the real estate section of the bar. So last time testifying for this bill, the controversy, so-called controversy we're talking about, are lines 1 through 4 of 382-1. If you recall, one thing this bill does is describe the kinds of advances made by a lender that retain a priority date as of the date of recording of the document. And one thing the bill does is set forth that construction advances, or advances made by a lender to complete construction of a project, have a priority date effective the date of recording of the document. The controversy arises over to what amount those advances must reach to retain the priority. The bill provides that advances made to complete construction, even if they exceed the face amount of the mortgage or trust deed, will have retain that priority date. So, for example, if you had $1 million mortgage recorded for a construction loan, and the lender subsequently had to complete the construction and make additional loan advances at a later time, even if those loan advances exceeded $1 million, those additional advances would retain priority as of the date of recording of the document. The real estate section has adopted amendments which would provide that the construction advances would retain priority only to the extent of the face amount of the document. So in the example I gave, the construction advances would retain priority up to the $1 million amount. Advances made beyond that amount or beyond the face amount of the original recorded document would not be given that priority benefit.
And that is not included in dash one amendments?
That's correct.
When you say have you communicated with Mr. Taylor those?
Yes, this morning I
kinds of pieces
talked to Mr. Taylor.
We talked this morning.
But we don't have them here.
The dash one and the dash two are, as I said, the same except for I have them in front of me. It says on page one of the printed bill, line 14, delete the semicolon. Isn't that what we talked about this morning?
Yes.
Well, I'm confused, Bill, so, and I think if I am, the other committee members will be too. Tell us how line 13 of dash 1 limits the construction loan to the amount of the original value, the sort of advances to the original value.
The language is would be in the bill itself.
Tell us where it is.
Page 2. And this is what I communicated to Mr. Taylor this morning.
No, you're communicating with us now, so let's...
Okay, I just... want you to know I'm being consistent with what I told Mr. Taylor this morning. On page 2 at the top, in lines 1 through 4 of the bill, that section addresses advances made to complete construction. And if you'll see on line 3, after the word property, it says whether or not such advances exceed the maximum principal amount stated in the line of credit instrument. We would propose changing that to after the comma, after property, state, to the extent the total outstanding advances do not exceed the maximum principal amount stated in the instrument.
Okay, and that is not embodied in dash one amendment?
No. Then in addition, though, as Mr. Taylor has indicated, lines 1 through 4 of dash 1 okay. would also be deleted.
Deleted?
Yes. Because the purpose of lines 1 through 4 of dash 1 was to alert a junior lender or a secondary lender that advances made to complete construction could exceed the face amount of the instrument, and to put that person on notice. If we are no longer going to require that those or provide that those advances retain that priority, there's no need to put that secondary lender on that kind of notice. That's why 1 through 4 of dash 1 would be deleted.
Okay. So you're recommending that we not take out, that we delete the dash 1 lines 1 through 4 and we insert on line 3 after property page 2 to the extent that what?
To the extent the total outstanding.
The
total outstanding. And then delete the words whether or not such. And then retain the word advances. And then after the word advances, insert do not.
Okay, Mr. Rodman.
Chair Cohen, my name is Steve Rodman with the Oregon Credit Union League. I worked with the real estate section in putting these amendments together, and this addresses the concerns that I raised at our first hearing, which were that a junior lien holder would not be able to have any control over their position if these construction advances could exceed the maximum principal amount on the loan. So these amendments would address that concern by limiting the construction advances to the maximum principal amount stated on the first line of credit instrument.
Okay, so with those amendments, then you're
satisfied.
Feel like it straightens out the understanding of how a junior position would be handled.
As a second lender, you'll know the maximum amount the first lien can have, and that's all I was looking for, was some certainty in that process.
Now, we just now have dash 2 amendments handed out to us, both of which is what we just went through, basically. Correct?
With the additional language that Mr. West added, but also taking out the first four lines.
Okay, so we really don't have dash 2.
We don't have amendments.
So let's look at these LC'd and have this sort of scheduled probably on Wednesday for work session to clarify. But is anyone else who'd like to speak to Senate Bill 382 amendments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may, I would like to note that the debtor-creditor section of the bar has also looked at the changes I've proposed today. And there are certain members of that group which feel that the original bill we proposed is satisfactory in its own form. And it really comes down to an issue to what extent you want to protect a construction lender. There are members of the debtor-creditor section who believe that a lender who is making construction advances should be allowed to continue to make those advances and be given the benefit of a priority, even to the extent that those advances exceed the face amount of the interest of the instrument. To encourage lenders to make those kinds of advances to complete construction. And I just wanted the committee to be aware of that issue. And
right. We will pick that up when we have the choice of the... I would ask you then to make sure that the original dash 2 amendments are what the debtor, your real estate section would be inclined to support. What we will have, dash three amendments, would be the amendments that we've just discussed today with the additional language on page two, and the committee will make that decision.
Madam Chair, as a matter of clarification, the dash two, I believe, came from the Denner-Carter section. What we are now proposing would be a dash three.
Right. The committee will have a choice then with respect to the dash two or the dash three when we get to it on Wednesday. And I think the committee, be clear now what our decision will be. It's either to make the compromise as we've heard, which would assist the credit unions in sort of limiting, not going beyond what the construction. Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
Will we have a chance to hear advocates for the two positions? I feel I need to have further hearing on this. I'm not clear which is better. We'll be hearing and work session.
We've had at least two hearings on this already.
On this issue.
Yeah, well, yes, on this issue.
Then maybe somebody better meet with me in my office.
But I think they need to do that. And we'll have you back, and you can be in a position to advocate why. It's clear from my standpoint what it's a policy question up or down on whether you think we ought to limit for protection of the second lien holder, you know, how...
I see the issue.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure, to my mind, which way to resolve it.
People have to lobby.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll set this over for Wednesday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Okay. 386 is held over. That has to do with the PERS splitting. Let's take up Senate Bill 427 in work session. This is the big state bar bill. And this piece, we have not had a hearing on one part of it, which has to do with the trust issue, the trust account issue, and we were asked to set that piece aside so that the Bar Association and the bankers go and discuss it, and we're here to hear what they have to say.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. That is exactly right. This is the hearing on that provision of the bill is currently before you, I believe, which has been changed, but the overdraft notification program. We've had a number of meetings with the Bankers Association, have improved the bill. They still do not support the bill, but we have improved the bill. We're still working with them, and we wanted to make our opening statements on behalf of the bill today. With me are two bar governors, Sylvia Stevens and Charlie Davis. So, Sylvia, I think we'll start with a brief statement, and then Charlie has some remarks, too.
Thank you. We're the Board of Governors and the membership of the bar, which has approved this program, is very much in favor. We believe it's going to be a very effective tool to help ensure not only the integrity of our profession, but to protect the public, which is the purpose of the bill. The legislation before you is enabling legislation. It is not specific as to how the program would work, and that is what we have been dealing with the Bankers Association. The concept envisioned by the board and by the bar is based on the programs that are in place in about 13 other states, which essentially would require the banks to notify the Oregon State Bar whenever a lawyer's trust account is overdrawn. There would be a statutory exception to the privacy generally afforded to bank records. The banks would also be allowed to charge a reasonable fee to the lawyer customer for the purpose of maintaining these reports and making the notifications to the bar. When the bar receives a notification of a lawyer trust account overdraft, then there would be a review or an audit by bar staff. And if there is no evidence of wrongdoing, then no action would be taken. We expect that this kind of a program will uncover situations of misappropriation of client funds if the experience of other states would be borne out here. And from the information we have developed from other states, it appears that somewhere on the order of they get reports of trust account overdrafts of 2 to 8% of the, on an annual basis, 2% to 8% of their members. Most of those don't involve wrongdoing, but some do. We recognize this kind of a program is not going to catch a clever thief, but in our experience with our own client security fund, the casualties are generally cases where the person is a substance abuser or under some other kind of influence where they're probably not thinking acutely, and we do think that this would serve as an early warning. And I feel if we catch one person, then the legislation will have served its purpose. In 1989, the Oregon Client Security Fund made payments that I believe were just under $200,000 to a variety of claimants. And in other states, those payments are upwards in the millions of dollars. Some observers believe that this trend is going to increase and continue with larger and larger payments on behalf of clients as hard times increase for lawyers. Our fund pays $25,000 per claimant, and many of the claimants have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars that they never can recover. We believe that an early warning kind of program is not only going to enable us to prevent the long-term abuse that often happens with one lawyer who is continually dipping into the client funds, but will also perhaps allow us to recover some of the money before it's gone, and that will enable the client to not lose nearly as much. This program does impose administrative burdens on the banking industry. We recognize that, and we've been working with them and continue to be willing to work with them to try to make those burdens as light as possible. It will also impose a burden on the Oregon State Bar and the lawyers whose fees support the administration of the bar. We believe that the administrative concerns of the banks are, of course, important, but they cannot override the public protection features of this bill. And so we would urge your approval of it.
Madam Chair, I'm Charlie Davis. Pardon me. I'm a public member of the Board of Governors of the Bar, which means that although I was elected by the Board of Governors, that was pursuant to action by the legislature that told the bar that the Board of Governors of the Bar should have three public members. So I feel my obligation not so, though attorneys are some of my best friends, my obligation is not so much to attorneys as to the people of the state at large. The overdraft notification provisions, it seemed to me, offer a great opportunity for us to provide some additional protection to persons whose trust accounts are in the hands of lawyers. That is, lawyers have control over trust accounts deposited in banks, and the obligation we seek to pursue here is to be certain that those trust accounts are properly handled. There will be some cases in which the problem arises because the lawyer can't add. We hope that the lawyers will add most of the time correctly, but the more serious problem is the ones in which a lawyer has a problem that he can't solve, and he seeks to solve it through the use of trust funds he's not entitled to control. This will not happen very often, but I can assure you that the evidence in other states where lawyers have misused funds from trust accounts show that the lawyer takes a lot more money from a trust account than he would take if he robbed the bank in the conventional way, that is, with a gun. And the objective here is not only to improve the level of professionalism in the bar, but from my point of view, it's certainly to provide some protection for consumer clients whose funds are deposited in the bank in trust accounts over which the lawyers have only a fiduciary responsibility and not a choice about using those funds to provide for their own needs. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Schumacher.
One of the main objections that the banks articulated to me about this bill is the high cost of not administering it, but setting it up, changing the computer programs or whatever it takes so that they will be equipped to do this. And which raises the question whether the bar is prepared to pick up that tab, reimburse the banks for their cost of setup as well as their cost of administration.
This was clearly something we hadn't contemplated, was us picking up the tab for doing that. We do recognize that there will be an administrative setup. I don't know specifically what banks in other states have done. There are currently 13 states running this kind of program. The state of Washington's program will be effective next Friday, this coming Friday, the 1st of March. So the banks up there, many of which are very large banks, have found ways to accommodate the program, and in fairly short time spans for many of them. There is obviously software programming available. I'm sure that it can be managed. We also feel that whatever kinds of fees the bank is going to charge, banks will charge to lawyers for maintaining and giving us the notification will perhaps in the, you know, over the long run help absorb some of that cost.
What's the penalty now for doing that, taking money unauthorized?
Well, it violates disciplinary rules.
Well, what's the penalty? Just maybe we ought to.
I guess it depends
on the penalty.
Yeah, it would depend, I think, on the severity of what happens, of what the conduct is, and you know, it can be from a 30-day, you know, from, I suppose, just from censure to disbarment, depending on what someone does. Every case is different. It's very difficult to say what the penalty is. There is no specific penalty for overdrawing your client trust account.
I noticed in the materials in the recent handout from New Jersey, New Jersey's legislation speaks to financial institutions that agree to report. In other words, it's permissive. I don't.
They do it on a midnight deadline. If subsequently covered, either by transfer or other credit to the account, the item would never show up as an NSF check. But Senate Bill 427 requires reporting irrespective of whether the instrument is honored. It would pose a very significant burden on financial institutions which do not immediately post all debits to review all unposted items daily to determine if among them was a check on a lawyer trust account. The proposed reporting requirement will obviously impose burdens upon financial institutions. The check must be identified as one being drawn on a lawyer trust account, and we've talked about that. In the final analysis, one seriously wonders whether advantages to the bar are worth the burdens that would be imposed and the uncertainties that are inherent in any reporting system. We would like to think that lawyers are honest. We know that some are not. I guess we could say that some bankers are not. Even those who are not, however, are not likely to overdraw their accounts. One would expect the most problems with lawyer trust accounts involve a misapplication and misuse of the funds without an overdraft being created. A requirement that NSF checks must be reported by banks will do nothing to prevent the misapplication and misuse of funds by the lawyer who intends to breach his trust and wrongfully use his client's money. We suspect that at best the bar will discover cases of inadvertence and perhaps negligence unassociated with fraud and breach of trust. Senate Bill 427 seeks to impose a burden on a sister profession without the accommodation for the burden and expense that it may cause. The bar is asking bankers to be watchdogs over the bar's members and in so doing to establish a principle of breach of confidentiality, which is antithetical to both professions. Given the practical problems of implementation, the doubtful benefit, we respectfully request that you delete Sections 8 and 9 of 427. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Senator Schumacher. Yeah, a couple of questions, Frank. On the breach of confidentiality, it seems to me that a trust account is sort of different from a private account, and the lawyer is acting as a trustee for his client's money to be used in ways that the client has consented to. In effect, this bill is bringing the bar in as a sort of not co-trustee, but is certainly a participant in to some extent in the fidelity of that account. Now, looked at that way, do you still have a problem with the confidentiality question?
Madam Chair, Senator Schumacher, yes, I do. First of all, there's no due process in notifying the owner, law firm, or attorney that we're giving this notice, nor is the client notified in the process. The similarity would be a trust account that's opened by a grandmother in the name of a grandson for college education. Should there be a release of that information without the grandmother's, the owner's approval? I don't think so.
No.
I understand that these accounts are different, but not in the eyes of a banker, Senator Schumacher.
Moving beyond that question, as you could tell from my questioning of the bar, I'm concerned at imposing on the banks the cost of retooling in order to handle this. If the banks could find a way to work that out with the bar, and if the bar then were willing to pick up the cost of that, would that ease your concerns regarding the bills substantially?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we would still have the confidentiality of the precedent. The biggest problem we have today, however, is the expense. I will tell you that if this bill passes, my expectation is that most of the smaller banks, and I don't know what I mean by small, but at least half of the banks in this state will not participate. As a matter of fact, if I was the largest banks in this state, I would ask that this bill pass because they'll have the lawyers' business from across the state.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we do have Bill Linden. Why don't you come on up? You have another amendment to Section 4, and then just Carson is here to comment or to respond to questions about that. Or you can both come together, or however that works. We have amendments to Senate Bill 427 on page relating to page 2, Section 4, another issue.
And Madam Chair, perhaps we could ask Mr. Bronner to come back later and perhaps speak to the notion of a random audit and how the industry might go
forward. Madam Chair, for your record, I'm Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. Appearing today with Justice Wallace Carson to discuss an amendment that we want to offer to Senate Bill 427, which is the result of a very recent occurrence. And with that, I'd like to turn over to Judge Carson to explain the amendment.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Wally Carson from the Oregon Supreme Court. This is, I hope you have in front of you, I believe you do, a proposed draft of an amendment, page 2, line 10. It will make a small change in Section 4 of the bill, ORS 9.250. The second part of the statute is what we're going to change. At the present time, the oath is after the bar examination and admission or approval by the court of the applicant. Is everybody?
I'd rather have them handed out when we.
Let me get right to the thrust of it. We have an oath-taking procedure. The statute is relatively narrow, primarily through our rules of admission, which we adopt in consultation with the Board of Bar Examiners. We have a much more relaxed oath-taking requirement, and we do have a case pending presently where a person who has been admitted is in Japan, would like to be sworn in as an Oregon lawyer. Bar examiners have approved him. We've approved him. Under the present statute, he'd have to come back from Japan to stand before us and take the oath. The bar for a long time has moved away. We can now take depositions over the telephone. And what we would like to do is have a more relaxed means of taking the oath. And in fact, it would, if we do by rule adopt the rules for admission that are presently in place, effectively, anybody who can take an oath, a consul general, a notary public, or whomever, could take. If the person is authorized to take an oath in that jurisdiction, that person can take the oath, send it to the court, and the person will be admitted. Rather than spell it all out in the statute, we've offered to allow us to do it by rule. And as I suggest, the rule would be, I believe, would be substantially to the effect that one who does not take the oath is provided, when we have the big session, may file an application for admission and will be allowed to provide, will be able to take the oath in front of any person who, let's see if I can find the language, um, before any person authorized by law to administer oaths in the jurisdiction within which the applicant may be. And that's what we would intend to adopt, something substantially similar as to that for our rule.
But you're satisfied that just changing it to by a court rule would be, you're not requesting anything beyond the hand and gross.
That's correct.
Part that
we would delete the part of the statute, that, Chapter 9, that tells us how to do it, mm-hmm. and we would then allow you to, or ask that you allow us to do it by rule, and we would do it by rule by broadening the availability of oath takers.
Questions from members mm-hmm. with respect to this amendment that's being offered here? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry to make you wait. Okay, Senator Shoemaker? Yes, this is a work session.
Appropriate to move that amendment?
Yes, it is.
I so move.
Senator Shoemaker.
Judicial Department amendment.
Okay, Senator Shoemaker has moved adoption of the Judicial Department amendment dated February 25th, dealing with page 2 of Senate Bill 427 on line 11, and it is written, and it, we do have a hand engrossed amendment for our review. Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Okay, folks, I guess Senator Hanby would like to have Mr. Bronner come up and comment with respect to the random audit part of.
And the experience perhaps in any other state, if that's more.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. Senator Hanby, I'm not familiar with the experience in other states, but I would see no reason why we wouldn't support a random audit. With proper notification and so forth. I would think that under the circumstances, that makes a whole lot more sense.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rick, are there any states of the 13 states mentioned that are having no problems implementing this that you're aware of?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I believe that Idaho can be said that they have no problems. They have very few accounts, and most of them are with their largest and next to largest bank, and most of them located in Boise or in northern Idaho. They have had no problems, but they're doing it manually. The statement was made that there is software available. We can't find it. Even in New Jersey, they are doing it manually. It is an exception.
Okay, any further comments from committee members? Pleasure of the committee.
Well, hopefully the bar will pursue any statutory language necessary for random audits.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
I guess I'm really... I'm not really persuaded that it's something that needs fixing. I don't think we have a lot of evidence that there's overdraft abuse of trust accounts that would lead to a finding of a lawyer who is abusing the trust account privilege. And it seems to me that, in addition to that, that if it's in the bar's interest to do this, and it may be, but really the bar ought to be picking up the expense of putting the program into effect. I mean, if it's worth enough to them to do, it should be worth enough to them to do that. And if they will do that, I would be willing to do that. I would think they could work it out with the banks to find a way to make the thing work. So at this point, I guess I'm not inclined in favor of making a change.
How about the folks down here?
Well, I'm sure I think sections 8 and 9 need to go out of the bill. I don't think they have made the case for it. And the random audit makes a lot more sense if you're trying to get at a case of fraud. The argument was made before. You leave a dollar in the account and you don't have to worry about it. we haven't dealt with that. And I think that if we need the ability to look for those problems, a random audit is a better solution.
I'm with the bar on this one.
Okay. Well, folks, we have a request for either. I think that probably we don't need any more information. It's time to make the decision. We either have a motion to delete sections 8 and 9 of this bill, or we move it as it is. And
Madam Chair,
excuse me, Bill.
And sections 10.
Why do we need 10?
Because section 10 relates to the same issue. There's a reference in section 10 relating back to section 9.
Okay. Senator Bunn.
Madam Chair, I move that we amend Senate Bill 427 by removing sections 8, 9, and 10.
Okay. Senator Bunn has moved that the committee delete sections 8, 9, and 10 of the Senate Bill 427. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
No.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, we have the bill as amended before us.
Is the bar still supportive?
Pardon?
Is the bar still supportive of it?
Oh, well, I think they have other parts of the bill that they want to deal with. Do you have any other amendments to be offered?
Not that I know of.
We've taken...
I'll move the bill, Madam Chair.
Wait, Senator Hanry's moved Senate Bill 427 as amended to the floor with a DUPES recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
No.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
No.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Okay, let's move to Senate Bill 393, which deals with recording duties of county clerks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 393 is a very extensive bill dealing with the recording of records in the county clerk's office. We have before us the Dash 2 amendments, and I believe the John Kaufman is here to answer any questions anyone may have as regards to the specifics of the bill. He also has in his possession to pass out an engrossed version of the Dash 2 amendments.
Okay, Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Kaufman, Clackamas County Clerk. Happy to respond to any questions.
You want to go through the amendments, Bill?
Let's sure.
See what we have before us here.
Madam Chair, the most significant part of the last time we were here, there was considerable discussion on the Section 6 and 7 of the bill. If you may remember, there was some controversy here between local government, the banks, and the clerks concerning the hours that the county clerk's office would be open, and the other issue requiring the county clerk shall return an instrument presented within a certain number of days. I direct your attentions to Section 6 and 7 of the engrossed version of the bill, and I think that would be the best way to figure out the fact that I believe, and what Mr. Kaufman has told me, that they have reached an accommodation in this area as to work out some of the technical language difficulties and technical problems in the area.
Yeah, these basically the counties have signed out, have
this is of some assistance to the counties with respect to their part of the counties, I guess, and the financial institutions, the people who need to do the recording, whoever they might be, the real estate people, the banks, the lawyers that are practicing in this area in terms of recording various types of instruments.
Madam Chair, what I can say is that the Oregon Land Title Association has approved the language that you see. AOC supports it, and the bar has taken no position. Mr. Bronner is here. He can tell you what the Bankers Association's position would be on these amendments.
Okay. Come on up, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. As the bill is before you in its hand engrossed version, we support and urge its passage.
Anyone else who'd like to speak to Senate Bill 393? Thank you. And we do have, John, these are, the Hannah Gross 393 is, in fact, encompassing of the, your understanding of the amendments that you need to have and have agreed on.
Yes, I went over the Dash 2 amendments, and they're incorporated in the Hannah Gross version.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then, the chair would move the dash. We haven't.
Yes.
Dash 2 amendments, is that what? Okay. Senate Bill 393 dash 2 amendments, the product of which is the hand and gross bill before you, dated 222. Are there objections to that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Then we're ready to move this as amended to the floor.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 393 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Hill moves Senate Bill 393 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
No.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Let's move to Senate Bill 405, a work session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was last before the committee on January 23rd, and before you there is a Dash 1 amendment. I'll discuss it after I mention what the bill does. It removes the requirement that the original mortgage obligation must specifically allow for renegotiation or indexing of interest rates without affecting the priority statute status of the mortgage obligation. The Dash 2 amendments would make the effective date of this shall apply to mortgages executed after the effective date of this act. That would add a Section 2 to the bill.
Dash 2 or Dash 1?
Dash 1. Excuse me. There is no Dash 2.
Right.
This was the only question we had was to make it clear when the effective date should be, and have you checked that the sponsor interest people who are interested in this?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I believe that they are satisfied with the amendments.
Anyone in the audience who'd like to speak to Senate Bill 405 and the amendments that we have before us that deal with questions, the question of the effective date? Okay. Then the chair would move Dash 1 amendments, dated 12891. Objections to doing so? Hearing none, sir. Senator Bunn.
Not objection to that, but I do want to ask a question before we do.
Then
as we've now amended it, we've taken care of the existing question of existing loans. But in the future, as I understand the bill, we could have a situation where if I hold a second mortgage, that the conditions of the first mortgage can change. For example, the balance of the first mortgage can change, and I am now subject to a renegotiated balance. Is that correct?
Yes, Bill.
I think it could be the case.
Okay, thank you. Are we at a point of discussion?
Yes, we are, certainly. Okay. This is a session on this bill.
I'm very uncomfortable with creating a situation where someone takes a second mortgage and then the conditions of the first mortgage, particularly the balance owing, is changed, and I'm not willing to do that. I think in the long run what we'll do is undermine second mortgages and deny that vehicle to people.
Okay. Do we have anyone from the debtor-creditor section that's here that wants to speak to the piece of this bill?
How could that happen? I mean, give me an example.
I don't have a clear example in mind. You know, if you're dealing with negotiating the interest rate, you may change the interest rate in relation to the balance due. But I think there need to be some absolutes that when you take a second mortgage, that you have locked in certain things, and we are specifically, you know, balance due is one of those things that couldn't change, and we're removing that wording from the bill. And even though I don't have a clear example today, I just think we're opening an opportunity to be unfair to someone who holds a second mortgage. Although, again, it's not someone who currently holds it, so the amendments are a great improvement, in my opinion.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, maybe we may be talking about current law. And looking to the bill, I think that the main thing that this does is in subsection 3, where it says paragraphs A to C of the section shall apply where the terms of the obligation provide that the interest rates, payment terms of balance due on the loan may be indexed, adjusted, renewed, or renegotiated in the mortgage received. By recordation discloses that fact. I think the way current law is that if you look back to sections A, B, C, D, E, these talk in current law all of what can be done without affecting priority, which includes renegotiation, increase of the underlying obligations secured by the mortgage, execution of new notes, extensions of terms in the mortgage. And from what I remember, there's some. And I feel uncomfortable because I don't want to be in the role of speaking for the proponents of the bill, that it removes some ambiguity that is in subsection 3, where it appears now that to have A, B, C, D, and E, and excuse me, and F, apply, it has to be in the mortgage agreement.
Okay. Madam Chair, well, I think the way I understood it, if you didn't have the condition or the right to renegotiate listed, then if I was giving a second mortgage, I could look at that mortgage and see, well, it isn't specified, therefore I'm protected. Now we're taking out that, so even if you looked at it and it did not say it could be renegotiated, it could be renegotiated. So if I understand the status quo, I don't have to worry about losing that right as a second mortgage holder unless it's in the document that I'm reading.
Senator Shoemaker first, and
I think my question doesn't arise. I hadn't realized what was just explained to me.
Yeah. Frank, you want to come up?
And I guess Senator Bunn's point is pretty cogent. If the second lender isn't in a position to protect himself because he doesn't know.
Well, but you can already the fact is you can already change all of these things already.
But if it's called out in the first instrument and the second lender is on his toes, he's going to read that and he's going to see it and he's going to negotiate and say, I'm only going to lend you this money under that first one, provided that you can get the first person to agree to not renegotiate or not advance the interest. Now he doesn't have a warning that might happen. I mean, if I understand this correctly, and I think
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Frank Browning with the Oregon Bankers Association. When we first looked at Senate Bill 405, we were opposed. Now that you've adopted the amendment to make it prospective, then those we come down on both sides of this bill, those that are in the second mortgage business are going to know that with the effective date of this act, that they better look at all instruments and assume that the magic language dealing with A, B, and C, and it's only A, B, and C, is there, even though it isn't there. The problem comes when you're trying to do a workout, when you're trying to redo a loan to reduce interest rates or to reduce payments, and you don't have the magic language in there for some reason, then you're unable to do that and you proceed with foreclosure. Under the current law, we don't have the option of dealing with those kinds of circumstances. Now that you've made it prospective, then all lenders in the state that deal with second mortgages will know that as of an effective date, all first mortgages may be renegotiated on the basis of these items which are listed in the statute. And you don't necessarily have to have that magic language, which Senator Bunn, in many instances, people couldn't find in the instrument anyway.
Go ahead. Okay. Madam Chair, I think I understand the issue, and clearly, you know, a sophisticated lender is going to be able to deal with it, but the private individual may find a very different situation, and I think we're opening a real problem area there that I'm not willing to do.
Okay. Senator Hamby, any question?
No comment.
Okay. Anyone else?
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's worth it to... I don't know if those concerns were expressed to the proponents of the bill. Maybe it's worth it to see if they can address them, because I don't see where we...
Well, I think there is a basic... It's sort of laid out, and I think that it's pretty clear. You either have an opportunity to work it out if you don't have language in, or you have some assumptions there that are notwithstanding, even if it doesn't happen to be in the contract. I think both, you know, it's a judgment call on our behalf, and I don't know how much you can work it out. It's a decision probably for us to make, and
Madam Chair, I would argue that with the amendments, the bill is clearly dealing with future situations. The lending institutions have the ability to put the magic language, as they call it, there to protect themselves. The fact that they don't do that, they become the victim. But that is, they've got the ability to protect themselves now by putting the language there, rather than creating a situation where someone who in good faith reads the fine print can't find anything and still becomes victimized because of the change we make. I would say let the lending institutions put the language there. They can have the protection if they need it, and we haven't taken away a potential protection from someone who still may need it down the road.
Okay. Senator Bunn has made his case. Is there anyone else who